This is side two of tape number 9, review of communications, and we're interviewing Admiral Donald McKay, and we're continuing the interview with Donald McKay, tape 1 and side 1, which I believe is about the only part of the tape, and we'll continue the interview with Donald McKay.
Spot. When did you go to work as communications officer in Washington?
1937.
When did you become aide to Secretary Morgenthau?
1937.
I see. About the first part of the year?
I went to Washington in March or April, I believe, of 37.
I see. And where did you come from to go to Washington?
From Oakland. I was on the Coast Guard Gunner Tahoe at the base here in Oakland, Alameda Base.
Now, the Tahoe was also a Lake-class cutter, was it?
The Tahoe was a sister ship of the Itasca.
It was a Lake-class.
Lake-class.
I see. Do you remember? This is a crazy question, but nobody seems to know the answer. Do you know what lake the Itasca was named after?
Well, I don't know, except that the only real Lake Itasca is up in Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
That's
okay.
Lake Itasca is considered by most people to be the headwaters of the Mississippi River. Okay. Actually, there's a small spring swamp above Lake Itasca that flows into Lake Itasca, and the water flowing out of Lake Itasca is the start of the Mississippi. In fact, just below the lake, right on the edge of the lake, there's a little bridge across the stream, and it says here the mighty Mississippi starts its 3,000 or whatever it is miles or 1,000 miles flow to the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
But Lake Itasca is where the lake, that's what it was named for.
Do you know where, now both the Itasca was made here in Oakland. It was built in Oakland. In a shipyard. The Itasca was built in a shipyard here in Oakland. Yes. The secretary took a train from Washington to Los Angeles, and then he boarded the Lurline at Long Beach and went to Honolulu. And you must have been on the Lurline also.
No, the secretary didn't take a train.
It's hard, I know, 40 years.
I would say that we probably flew out in a Coast Guard Lockheed. Well, I don't know what we call it. Lockheed Vega? Lockheed. We had a two-engine Lockheed.
Must have been a Lockheed 10, same kind as Amelia Earhart's airplane.
Yeah, it was a... Well, I don't know, but it was what we called the secondary's plane at that time. The secondary wouldn't... You got me.
Was his family with him?
You got me. Train.
Was his family with him?
We came out on a Santa Fe Chief. Came out on the Santa Fe Chief, I guess, from Chicago. Santa Fe Chief. Could be.
Was his family with him?
Yeah, family was with him. The family, these trips that I made with the secretary, most of them were family trips. He was on a vacation. And I travel as communication aide. I carried the confidential codes with which the secretary communicated directly with the president. There was a Navy officer on the other end in the White House, and I was on this end. And that was what was... I didn't think my memory was that bad, but you now say We came out on, I will concede, we came out on a super chief. And I, if I remember correctly, it wasn't too long after the super chief started running, and I believe the secretary arranged to go up and visit the cab of the train. Okay, you pulling it out. I'd forgotten. Yes.
Then, was this a vacation that had been to go to Honolulu for a long time, or was this something that came up because the White House wanted to know what was going on?
I was aide for 4 years. I was assigned, in fact, I was ordered to Washington as aide and assigned collateral duties as Assistant Chief of Communications. I was number three in communications. There was another assistant chief senior to me, Fritchie, who since has died. But I was assigned.
What was that name again?
Fritchie.
Yeah.
F-R-I-T-S-C-H-E. Fritchie.
You remember his first name or initials?
Ed, I think. EF or something, Fritchie. I can get that for you.
Okay, he was your, in the communications department, he was the only one over you.
He was
in Washington.
He was immediately over me. The boss of communications at the time was Commodore Webster. He was chief of communications.
W-E-B-S-T-E-R?
W-E-B-S-T-E-R. Edward Mont Webster. He was lieutenant commander at the time, retired and on active duty. He lives in Washington, D.C. today.
And he may still be alive then. He might still be alive then.
Oh, he's still alive, yes.
Well, then he, yes, if you have it, I'll take that address.
It was a plan. The Amelia Earhart deal was... information was just incident that had happened at that time. No, the secretary and his family had planned to go to Honolulu and the islands for a vacation. It was quite a time ahead.
I see. So then probably just before you left, though, he probably got a call from the White House saying, while you're over there...
No, I don't think so. I think that the reason the secretary was so interested was the Coast Guard was under the Treasury Department, and the secretary, and I say this having been close to him for 4 years, was very much interested in every activity of the Treasury Department. And because the Coast Guard had helped in the communication planning for the Earhart case and was in on the search, and the ship came into Honolulu at that time, he was vitally interested in getting first-hand information on what had happened. Probably interested to find out if the Coast Guard had dropped the ball.
Were you present when Commander Thompson gave his verbal report?
I'm sure I was. Because never did the secretary talk or interview or talk with anybody in the Coast Guard when I was with him that I... accompanying, but what I was with him at the time.
Because anything to do with the Coast Guard, you were supposed to help whatnot.
Yes, I was supposed to help fill in afterwards information.
Okay, just a moment. Let me turn this over. I'm getting near the end of this tape, and I don't want to lose any of this, because actually, your memory is very good. The interview that Commander Thompson... as commanding officer of the Itasca, when he came to see the secretary. Do you remember anything at all about what his verbal report
The only thing that I remember, which sticks to me vividly in my mind is, and I'm not sure whether it was the Captain Thompson or Frank Kenner or another officer involved in it, I remember their vivid description of the final communications with the Earhart case. In other words, where they made the statement that she seemed to become very much excited and rattled and started screaming into the microphone, and then it was all over. And they were in at that moment, supposedly, which is the last moments of the flight. They were in good communication with her at the time. But the statement was made something to the effect that she apparently became excited and irrational in the fact that she realized that they were running out of fuel and they couldn't find the island. They couldn't see the smoke from the Itasca. The Itasca was making smoke, and the direction finder couldn't give them any help.
Did they ever say why the direction finder couldn't give them any help?
The direction, at that time, the state of the art in high frequency direction finding was very crude, and you couldn't get a good fix. And besides, the direction finder was the Coast Guards on the island. The plane didn't have a direction finder for her. She was transmitting on a high frequency, and the portable direction finder on the island or on the ship was trying to get a bearing on her. And the state of the art was such in that time that it was very crude, to say the least.
And it never was able to get any kind of bearing.
They never were able to get a good bearing on her at all. Now, the reason... This was one of the reasons why we in Washington, in our original correspondence and discussions in this communication plan, insisted that she have a 500 frequency transmitter so that we could take bearings on her. We knew the limitations of high frequency direction finding. Today, of course, it's good. Yeah, radar today. But we had been involved in several flights, transatlantic flights and things like that, in which we would not become a party to unless they agreed to certain communications. And they agreed to have 500 kilocycles available, and yet when they went off at Miami or somewhere, they dumped it.
Then you believe you had an understanding with Amelia Earhart that
there's
she was to have 500.
There's no doubt about it, because I sat in on that as representing the Coast Guard in the discussions and in the correspondence. I believe you'd find correspondence, but there were discussions with the people that contacted the Coast Guard in Washington in connection with the thing. And I believe that Bob Finley would confirm this, that we did not know that there was no 500 aboard until after they'd left the States.
The direction finder, I'll try and jog your memory again,
like a
train. The direction finder was a Navy direction finder.
A Navy one?
Yes. It was borrowed from the Navy.
Yeah, well, the Coast Guard at that time was not involved in high frequency direction finding, except in connection with room running activities, we had used certain direction finders, but we had no portable direction finders at that time.
Well, the Navy had developed a rather experimental portable. It was a more or less a homemade affair. It wasn't a proven, reliable, recognized model. It was something that had been made that worked.
It was still an experimental stage.
And
the Milwaukee involved in that search? Cruiser Milwaukee?
No. No.
What Navy cruiser was involved?
I can't think of any cruiser. There was five destroyers, a battleship, and one carrier.
What battleship?
Colorado.
Colorado. Maybe I'll think of the Colorado. I don't think any of those had high-frequency direction finding either.
No, I don't think so.
No.
No, it was experimental.
Yeah.
These logs here, from Commander Thompson, never gives any reason, per se, of why the direction finder, they took the direction finder and they put it on the island. And the Navy offered the Coast Guard to send an experienced radio man with the direction finder. And Commander Thompson refused on the grounds that the Coast Guard had plenty of its own experienced radio operators and did not need any Navy radio operator, which sounds possible circa the 1930s.
I am a bit on the prejudice side, of course, biased, let's put it that way.
Hi.
It's Mr. Long, my wife, Grace.
How do you do, Grace, I believe.
In high-frequency direction finding, such as it was for a long time, ahead of the Navy in the thing, and the actual use of a direction finder didn't require any expertise
from one different
communications.
Type.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Well, anyway, they put the direction finder on the island.
Yeah.
Mainly to get it away from the ship because of the steel in the ship.
That's right. At that time, that was one of the big drawbacks of high-frequency direction finding is that on a ship, everything got distorted.
So they put it on the island. Did you ever hear where they put how they put it on the island? Was it in a building or?
No. If I remember correctly, this was a small portable set. In other words, a box-like affair with a loop on the top of it. And all they had to do was to carry it ashore and put it down. I believe it ran on a gasoline auxiliary generator. Now, I'm not sure whether it was run by batteries or generator, but if I remember correctly, this one ran with generators, and that was one of the problems. They had to take the generator and the gasoline and so on for it ashore.
Well, they ran it on both. Both is correct. They ran it on batteries, and then they charged the batteries
charged
with
the batteries.
Generator.
Okay, they had the combination. Okay.
I'm trying to locate where on the island the direction finder was placed. That is, was it put in one of the buildings on the island, or was it put in a tent, or?
It was my understanding that it was just set up in the sand. Clear of any obstacles.
You would possibly inside of a tent to keep it out of
could
the...
Could be, or it could be right out in the open, because it would probably be weatherproof.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Well, what? Do you remember anything about this at all?
No, but I think you'll find that all covered in that communication report.
Okay. It's funny, I'll have to locate that report.
As I say, I would say, from a source of information, that communication report, if it could be found, would give you more of a total story, communication-wise, than anything you could get from anybody that's trying to recall from 40 years back.
As of March 1978, I have not been able to find any trace of that communication study. And again, I say, maybe it might be worth one more effort back in Washington, D.C. to try and locate it, if not locate it, to ascertain that there ever was one.
He said that he was present when Commander Thompson came to visit
the secretary.
But he said something else I just don't quite understand. He said that Commander Thompson had been at sea for a month, and they just got into port the night before, and they'd had a very, very bad, hard cruise with all sorts of problems, and that he arrived in rather bad circumstance that morning.
I don't know. But that's strange. I've known Anthony for a lot of years, almost 50. He was chief radio man on the ship when I first reported on the old Coast Guard destroyer trip.
Well, Chief Bellarts was a Chief Bellarts. Bellarts, B-E-L-A-R-T-S.
Oh, Bellarts.
Bellarts.
Yeah.
He was the chief radio operator on the Itasca.
On the Itasca.
And he was under Ensign Sutter. Sutter was an ensign and communications officer.
Yeah.
And then Chief Bellarts was the chief radio man. Then there was four radio men under him. Three of them belonged to the Itasca, and one
to the Sutton
was a Frank Cipriani from the Taney.
Oh. Well, have you talked to Bellarts?
Yes. I've talked to Bellarts at great length. And Chief Bellarts told me that the reason the direction finder never got a bearing, then every time that the fellow switched to get a bearing, the signal strength would go to zero, was because it was a sort of a homemade direction finder, and it did not have slip rings between the receiver and the loop. So you could only turn the loop about 180 degrees in each direction, and they did not have a stop. And somebody had turned the loop and pulled all the wires and broke all the wires out of the loop. So when you switched to the loop, you got nothing because it was disconnected. The wires were broken.
Well, I won't dispute that. I wasn't there.
Yeah. No, I just wondered if there was any confidential report that had been made that, at the time that they decided just to better left unsaid.
As I say, I would think that all of that information is
in that
communications report.
The other guy,
I just can't, after all these years, recall a thing. But I go back to the thing. I think that every bit of information that came to Washington, everybody's comments and everything that came to Washington, are all in that communication.
I'll have to find that report. I didn't know it existed.
Now, as I say, I can't say, but I know that it was an extensive report, probably the most extensive communication study that was made. It gives all the transmitting and so on, if I remember correctly, chronologically of what had happened, what happened all the way down the line, as well as comments and opinions of people. And then it came up to the conclusions of who failed and so on. These studies were made primarily to find out where we were at fault, or where something was at fault, so that we could make an improvement in communication.
I believe that the most important thing that came out of this incident out there in the Pacific, or this accident, was the realization that when you are working now on someone who takes off in New Guinea and flies across two or three time zones, and arrives. In fact, it flew across 3.5 time zones, arrives in Howland Island. And you have stations down in Samoa. You have stations at Nauru Island. You have stations in the Gilbert. You have stations in San Francisco and Honolulu. You have the ship operating at Howland Island, which is on 11.5-hour time, and have the island operating on 10.5-hour time because they wanted to be the same as Honolulu. You have everybody operating on different times that after a while it became so confusing that nobody knew what time anything was going on. And they converted, after this, one of the major recommendations that in an emergency, everybody go to Greenwich Mean Time.
Well, that is what I think the study did. The
I
study
believe that was one of the results.
Converted
yes.
everything to GMT, yeah. And at least everything they could. The radio logs were kept, supposedly, I believe, the Coast Guard radio logs were kept in GMT.
No, they were kept on ship time.
Ship time, well, okay. Then I'm sure you'll find that this study is converted to GMT. The message is, though, signed off with a time of GMT.
That's possible. I am not yeah, really sure.
The messages should show, the filing time should be GMT on those.
One of the things I'm having difficulty with, now you probably gather by now that I'm an old radio man, communications man.
Well, I think you know more than I do about communications, anyway.
Well, I don't know about that. But I do know that one of the things I'm having trouble with is the old Z signals. Because I never knew those. I knew the Q signals, but not the Z for Z.
That was the Navy's Q signals.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the logs, they keep using these Z signals, and I don't know what they mean. And I haven't been able to find one yet. A book.
Oh, ask Bob Finley.
Okay.
Ask Bob Finley.
All right. That pretty well concludes.
Did the T-22 have code capability as well as voice?
It had T-22 was a portable, had voice and code.
I see.
It was mainly a voice transmitter.
Was there just one frequency?
No, it had more than one frequency. It worked in the 2,000 to 3,000 band. I think that was the limit.
I see.
Now I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But this was a portable. It was developed when I was on the trip, and Anthony was there. It was tested on the trip when Anthony was a chief. It was built and used it first in the floods in 1930 and down in Mississippi.
So this was designed about 1928 then.
Yeah, I would say 1928. Yeah.
It had a variable oscillator then.
Yeah, it was.
Wasn't crystal controlled?
No, it wasn't crystal controlled. I don't think so now.
Okay, I won't hold you to that. That's all right.
Many of our sets were previously master oscillator controlled were converted to crystal control at later times. So it may be, but this T-22, I'm pretty sure, was a small portable in the 2,000 to 3,000 band. Ask Bob Finley.
Okay, will do.
These people from in this original planning involved everybody that might be involved in it, in the original planning in Washington, the discussions. And it was done for a number of other cases. And it was the only time the Coast Guard never would have gotten into this had they known that she didn't have a transmitter on 500 kilocycles. I can assure you that. Yeah. My memory remembers that much.
Turned out to be her undoing.
Ship to shore searchlight, the plane approaches island and makes smoke signals during the daytime. We have used in the latter part of the rummy days and so on, a book, if I remember correctly, about so thick.
About an inch thick.
And about
like, 8 by 11.
Like a normal typewriter page size. And it had a code and decode sections in it. And seems to me just offhand that it was a four-letter code. Now, I'm not sure.
That's about what we used in the first part of World War II. When I was on aircraft, we had a little book, and we had words and phrases that were
I think we'd gotten rid of it by that time. It had been compromised. I think that it got rid of it. I'm not sure. But you can find that Anthony could have answered that.
What the code A was.
Yes, because he was in cryptography, because Anthony could answer that. Bob Finley may be able to do it. Webster probably could, but his memory probably, he's older than I am by 15 years or more. His probably memory is better. But code A, I'm sure that was the book. That was our first code that the Coast Guard devised for themselves. Guam or a truck or someplace like that. And all of this information to me is, there's no confirmation, it's speculation. And having been on the conference right after the search down there and heard the commanding officer and the communication officer and so on discussing the matter, I have no reason to believe that she did anything but dive in the ocean.
One thing I'd like to clarify, Commander Thompson, there was reports in the press that she had become hysterical and had more or less screamed and whatnot. And Commander Thompson, in a letter to someone above him in the Coast Guard who had asked about this, denied that she had become that hysterical. Deeply concerned, her high-pitched voice, but had perhaps he written that just to alleviate the pain and suffering of her family or something? Or
I would, as I say, still trusting on 40 years of memory, I am sure that Commander Thompson, or one of the people that was in on the conference, made the statement that she became, that her voice sounded like that she was had become hysterical, and that she was screaming into the microphone. That was said, and as I say, of all the things that I remember, that has stuck vividly in my mind, and that was the part that convinced me that she didn't go off somewhere and landed in truck or Guam or somewhere.
Do you remember the discussion about either I'm running low on fuel or 1/2 hour's gas remaining? There was two interpretations. One log said, I'm running low on fuel. The other log said, I only have 1/2 hour of gas remaining.
Yes, I remember that. And it was my information, my impression from what I remember now, that she shortly before she became hysterical, and when they were sending up the smoke from the Itasca and so on, that she made the statement she had 1/2 hour of gas remaining.
Do you have any reason to believe that the Japanese had anything to do with her disappearance after the crash?
No.
Never had any reason to believe?
I think that she was within, not too far away from the islands. She wouldn't have to be too far away from the islands to be out of sight. And that she just crashed into the ocean, and that was it. And when you get down in that country, you know that a search would, not knowing where she might be, where to look, that any kind of a search you made down there couldn't cover anywhere near the range that she might be. And I don't think the Japanese had anything to do with it. That's my personal opinion.
Your personal opinion was then that there's not some big international conspiracy to cover this all up?
No, it was just a plain, sad case of an attempt to fly the Pacific in an area there with poor communications, poor facilities.
Okay, that concludes the interview with Admiral McKay. I think to sum it all up, there were three or four significant things that he had to say, and one was that Secretary Morgenthau was not there just because of the Amelia Earhart disappearance. It was a vacation he and his family had planned a long time before. Another thing I think he had to say that was extremely important and something that bears possibly further investigation on my part, and that is the fact that he is positive that a communication study was made. And this will be amplified later on, I think, when I get the Finley tapes on here, because Bob Finley was positive that a communication study was made also. Unfortunately, Mr. Webster, who was communications officer at the time, died. But before his death, Bob Finley talked to him, but he really couldn't put anything together. I talked to Admiral Wayshe Jr. about this, and he stated that he did not know of any communication study. But it was a common practice at those times, mandatory Coast Guard procedure, that a communication study be made of distress cases where significant communications were involved. And these cases were numbered. I think it might be significant to go back and find out if I can find a discontinuity of numbers. At any rate, if there was a communication study made, it has never been made public. It's never been found to this date as of March 1978. And as I stated earlier, the Coast Guard historian told me that I would never find it. And if it ever existed, it doesn't exist now. I thought it was very, very interesting that Admiral McKay was sure that he had one in his possession. And I really think there's substance to that. I don't know quite else what to say about it. The other thing I think was significant, that here was Admiral McKay, who at the time was lieutenant, aide-de-camp to Secretary Morgenthau, who was directly in contact with the captain of the Itasca, with the head of the Hawaiian section, with the communications officers, and Captain Parker of the 12th Naval District, plus with Secretary Morgenthau himself, and also as one of the assistant communications officer at headquarters in Washington, D.C. He was of the direct opinion that Amelia Earhart was not on any kind of a mission, and nor the Japanese had anything to do with her disappearance. She simply ran out of fuel, could not find the island, and crashed. I think those were very significant things that he had to say, at least as his opinion. So that concludes the interview with Admiral McKay. I think next we'll pick up Admiral Dobler. Admiral Dobler was on the Itasca for quite a period of time just before the Itasca went on the search down there. And then later, Admiral Dobler in 1938 was communications officer of the 12th Coast Guard District at San Francisco and forwarded Commander Thompson's report to headquarters. In fact, his is the cover letter that's on the front piece of the radio transcripts that Commander Thompson forwarded to Captain Parker of the 12th Naval District upon his return from the Amelia Earhart search. So we'll This concludes the Admiral McKay tape. Now we'll go to the Admiral Dobler's tape.
This is an interview with Rear Admiral Harold, H-A-R-O-L-D-J, as in Juliet, Dobler, D-O-E-B-L-E-R.
D-O-E-B-L-E-R, 1-D.
Okay, the spelling of the last name is D-O-E-B-L-E-R. And we are in Babson Park, B-A-B-S-O-N-P-A-R-K, two words, Florida. It is Tuesday, May the 13th, 1975,
and it's approximately 4:30 in the afternoon, and we are in the living room of Admiral Dobler with his wife, and my wife and I are here, and we're going to continue the interview from here.
Accumulated.
One question. While you were in Samoa, did you ever take a little jaunt or a little trip on a tug that was stationed there?
I knew the commanding officer's tug quite well and knew him until he was a captain and had retired and passed on.
That was up the Ontario?
I don't remember really the name. I imagine that would have been the name of the tug.
There was a tug
that used to go to these outlying American islands and pick up copra and do other things around the American.
What was his name offhand? You knew who was captain of the tug?
I was just talking to his wife not very long ago.
Many years ago.
Ted Wirth. W-I-R-T-H, yeah.
Many years ago.
Ted Wirth. W-I-R-T-H, yeah.
But he was Navy,
yeah. Oh, yeah, that was all Navy. Actually, we had taken that over as a coaling station back, I think, in the Spanish-American War time. And then it, of course, the Navy converted to oil, and it wasn't any, didn't serve any useful purposes of that. And it became really a staff there, and they had a governor, and the Navy supervised the island. They had three districts in Samoa, as I remember. There was Swain's Island, which we went to, and the reason that, now Derby was aboard when we went to Swain's Island, they'd had a typhoon go through and they had knocked all the breadfruit down off of the trees and they were in need of help. And we were relatively close and on our way to Samoa at the time, so we stopped and took them in things like dried beans and rice and things that would keep. But I remember Derby went ashore there, and this was American possession, but the whole island was owned by a German. And they had natives from all over what I would call Micronesia now, or that general area, who worked the copra. But I remember Derby went ashore there, and this was American possession, but the whole island was owned by a German. And they had natives from all over what I would call Micronesia now, or that general area, who worked the copra and did whatever other work that had to be done. But the women wore what I would call a lava-lava. It's a wraparound, like a big towel or something. And their breasts were there. And Derby wouldn't let any of the men go ashore until the women put some kind of a shirt or something on. And we had them out on the ship.
What was Captain Derby's reasoning behind that?
Well, he felt that the men were too immature, I suppose, to see naked breasts. I mean, these young sailors and all, or they may get the wrong idea. This is the only thing. Now, Derby was a New Englander. He was a rather starchy type of individual in the sense of, I'll say, religion and regulations. He did everything by the book, whether it was the Bible or Coast Guard regulations. He was a wonderful skipper. He was an excellent seaman. Night before, we had had a farewell party for an officer that had been transferred, and the next morning, we had a conference at 9 o'clock, and then we sailed at noon. And
you remember who the farewell party was for?
I think it was George Nelson. I can't remember. I mean,
well, then if Nelson left on the if it was a farewell party for George, and if you went as commanding officer on the Tiger, who would be navigation officer on the Itasca?
Well, I can't remember whether Bill Swanson was whether he. I was trying to think of who we had. We had Dick Mellon and Dutch Sutter.
Okay, that's the end of tape number 9. We'll start tape number 10 now, interviewing Admiral Dobler.